You're welcome along to the Keith Andrews Show. We've got loads to get through this week. Joining me yet again by popular demand is Joe.
By popular demand, by yeah. Who? No one else is available.
No. Very popular demands. How are you?
Yeah, great. Good to be with you. How's things? Week.
Yeah, really well. Good. Really well. You've had Kenny in for a couple of nights, haven't you?
It's funny, when you've Kenny in for a Tuesday and a Wednesday, you kind of come in Thursday a bit tired.
What do you mean by that?
It's just full on, that man. He never seems to tire, slow down,
he's
stop
like
talking.
At home.
We had that conversation the other day. I mean, I just...
With Kenny?
No, behind his back, obviously.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can talk freely now because I'm on Facebook. Yeah, exactly. And he doesn't have the internet. But I mean, we have talked in the office about, does he ever have an off moment?
Because I'm not so sure he does.
He just comes in and it's like full tornado of energy. Yeah. All right, lads. And then he's on air and it's 3 hours of non-stop talking during the ad breaks and on air.
Yeah.
Like, there's no difference with Kenny off air and on air.
No, there's not. I think people should realise that.
So
What did I hear about a rowing challenge?
Well,
you're up for it, by the way, I've heard.
Vaguely up for it. Kenny was in short, and we were doing a competition for sports gear. McSport.ie was the competition.
Good plug.
And we just mentioned all the gear they have, including rowing machines. And on air, Kenny starts going, no. I'm like, well, shh. We're trying to promote these things. he just talked about his hatred of rowing machines. So I don't know if you had something like that.
Yeah, when
you're
injured, it's not a nice one.
Well, he said it was just one of those things, like you do circuits and various bits and bobs. Yeah. He said the rowing machine, he said it's brilliant for you, it works everything, that's great, but mental torture.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Yeah.
Just grim, he said. So he said he can't, he says he goes to the gym now, he can't even look at a rowing machine. So the good people at McSport.ie got back onto us and said, if you two want to do a rowing challenge against each other, we would facilitate that.
Okay.
So, I mean, look, I said I was vaguely open to
Kenny
it.
Was just no.
Kenny said, absolutely not, I'm not doing that. And we're talking 8 minutes of rowing here. It's first to 2K. They reckon that could be 8 to 9 minutes of hard rowing, but he says no.
I'd do that.
Well, I mean, you can...
We have a three-way?
we can, yeah. If you can convince Kenny to do it, then we can have a three-way.
Okay, let's do that. Okay, let's have a little look what we've got coming up today. Champions League chat, we'll discuss Liverpool, Man United's comeback last night, and also Spurs, the Ireland under-21s manager job available, a little bit of speculation as to who's going to exactly get that. Premier League relegation scrap after 11 games, who's going to struggle, who's going to be getting cleared out in the coming weeks. We've also got Stephen Reid on, who's been a little bit in the quiet zone for the last few months after leaving Crystal Palace. So I'll be interested to see how Stephen's been getting on. And then we're going to talk about derbies, Man U, Man City this weekend. And I'm at Sheffield United versus Sheffield Wednesday tomorrow, which I'm really looking forward to. So to bring us into the Champions League chat, speaking on Virgin Media Sport last night, Graeme Souness and Mick McCarthy discussed Juventus' substitutions.
Allegri has a lot to answer for, and he'll get absolutely hammered in Italian press because they're, you know, everything's about tactics in Italy. And his Bezzaglia, his substitution by bringing Bezzaglia on, why has he done that? Because he's good in the air and he's a big old boy and he'll attack things because they've got Fellaini on. And that momentum shift then was enormous. That was an invitation for Man United to go long. And all of a sudden, and it's subconscious when you're in a game like that, you've got the ball, there's 5 minutes to go or 10 minutes to go, and all of a sudden you're not running forward to accept it, you might be standing still, you might be taking a step backwards. And the whole momentum, the whole thing shifted in that substitution when they brought Bezzaglia on for me. And obviously, Fellaini.
They put Cuadrado at right wing back.
Who had a good game.
Yeah. They weren't under a great deal of pressure when he made that substitution.
Virgin Media Sport is the new home of European football in Ireland, with more than 400 UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Nations League games live this season. Virgin Media Sport is exclusive to all Virgin Media TV customers, who can also download the TV Anywhere app and stream it all the action whenever and wherever they like.
I think you're doing about 300 of those games, are you?
No, not quite. Not as many as Kev.
No, nobody's doing as many as Kev.
I listened to the football show coming in this morning. Kenny was in the studio, obviously. Yeah. Graham's there making the point. I know you were talking to Kenny about it last night. Graham's making the point about the substitution, Barzagli. I didn't particularly have a problem with it. And I thought, and it surprised me, his comments, that considering he's spent time in Italy, he's obviously seeing Italian teams jump through the age, going defensive mind in the last 10-15 minutes. Not a real issue seeing them out. I was listening to Martin Keown commentating, and he said it straight away. And he was right in terms of the way the momentum had shifted. But I thought it was more so what Man United did with bringing Fellaini and Mata on, obviously Mata with the goals, but I thought they reacted to bringing Fellaini on knowing that United would go a little bit more direct by bringing Barzagli on. And you brought him on at Old Trafford a couple of weeks ago and seeing the game out fairly comfortably at Old Trafford.
Yeah.
But I did think it was a bit of a momentum swing, mainly from Fellaini coming on and doing his usual nuisance job, which I did think he did very, very well.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I think Manchester United fans might be in two minds about this result. It's a fantastic win, and there's no doubt. And you go to Turin, and since they won in 03, remember Giggs scored that amazing goal?
Yeah.
Juventus have only lost once at home
and
in the Champions
magnificent
League
record
since
there.
Then. Yeah. Once. So now of their three defeats in Turin in the last 15 years, yeah. two of them are Manchester United. So it's an amazing result, and it's a big fill-up for the team and the general mood of things. By the same token, I mean, Juventus had 55% possession. They had 23 shots to Manchester United's 8. They bossed the game. Cuadrado scored. Should have scored that chance. Dybala hit the crossbar. I mean, they bossed the game again, really.
But I thought Man U looked a lot more comfortable than they did. Certainly the first half at Old Trafford.
Mm.
I thought Juventus' first half a couple of weeks ago was the best 45 minutes I'd seen in Europe this year. I thought they were that impressive.
Yeah.
I really did. United were all over the place, and they were just in the midst of coming back through this tricky spell of the West Ham game. But since then, they've been on a good run.
They have, you know.
Is that where you were going with that point about Man United fans will be a little bit mixed?
Well, I mean, there's just a point. So, like, I was reading Jamie Jackson in The Guardian talking about Fellaini and Mata coming on. Mata, you've no real problem with coming on. Although Kenny's argument last night was, like, why not start Mata? Why not try and be a bit more creative?
But I thought he made a mistake in the first game by playing Mata because I thought they got overrun in midfield.
Doesn't have the legs.
So I thought it was the right decision.
Okay, fair enough. You know, that's interesting. But look, there is a point where, you know, so in The Guardian, instead Mourinho refused to buckle. He threw on the pairing of Mata and Fellaini with 11 minutes remaining. It proved a masterstroke. Like, there is a point with United where you look at all the... in fairness, there is a point with United where you have to wonder if for all the money spent and all the brilliant players they have, like, it still just does boil down to throwing a big lad on and pumping the ball
up.
Yeah,
last night, Joe, I certainly didn't have a problem with that against a really good side like Juventus. My argument with that would traditionally be that has been the plan B, hasn't it? Where they play in a certain way, which we don't really know what way that is. We know the way Liverpool play, although that has changed this year. We know the way Manchester City, we know the way Sarri plays at Chelsea. We don't know what way Jose Mourinho's Manchester United. They haven't really got a style where you'd say, well, that's the way they try and play football. It's not with massive width with Martial or Rashford keeping the width or narrow forwards like Liverpool, etc. And plan B has always been, even against the lesser teams in the Premier League, let's get Fellaini on. And I've always said that is not good enough for Mourinho, for Manchester United, and the players he had. But last night, so I'm coming here this morning, I'm going to have to kind of eat my words about Fellaini because constantly I've been criticising him coming on as the saviour.
Yeah.
But last night I didn't have a problem with it. Even with 10 minutes to go, I thought, yeah, do we?
Totally fair enough last night. But my point is, this cannot be the blueprint.
I agree.
You know what I mean? Like against Bournemouth when they're 1-1, if it's Fellaini on, like really. And, you know, I think the most telling thing about Mourinho is still that, what is the best team? So what's the best back four? Can any Manchester United fan answer that? What is the guaranteed go-to back four? What's the best midfield three? No one knows.
No.
And what's the best front three? So he doesn't actually know a single line of his team.
Yeah. The only one he knows is De Gea.
And you could say, look, Lindelof is doing a better job now and he's in increasingly. But like one bad game and he'll be back out.
Yeah.
And it could be McTominay in a back five.
Yeah.
So you kind of think 3 years in, what's the best team? You compare that with the very best teams like Liverpool. You can reel off the Liverpool best team, give or take, every time. There's a consistency about it and a momentum about it. Like still, look, it's a fantastic result.
And it's a good run they're going on. Since that 3-2 win over Newcastle where they came back early parts of October, Chelsea 2-2 away, lost home to Juve in that game we've already mentioned. Then they've beat Everton and Bournemouth.
Yeah.
Bournemouth away, came back again, and last night.
Yeah.
So I think there's signs of it. The whole Rashford, Martial debate. The Martial debate is just comical because he is an outstanding ball then. I would imagine in the last 2 to 3 transfer windows, Manchester United have fended off some serious interest in him from other clubs.
And Mourinho would have sold him. There is no doubt. That's been reported unequivocally. And like the list of players that Mourinho has burnt. I mean, you're even looking at Cuadrado last night and you're thinking, there's another one.
Yeah.
I mean, he's got through a fair amount of talent, Mourinho, and discarded it. Like, you kind of wonder with Martial. Here's a question for you. You look at Raheem Sterling. Where would Martial be if he had been working under Guardiola for the last 3 years?
I totally agree with you, Joe. Totally agree with you, which is when it goes back to January. And the reason that Alexis Sanchez signed for Manchester United was purely financial. Fact.
Yeah.
Same city. Can't even use the geographical one. Can't even use the sunshine. Oh, I want to stay in London. I want to go to Madrid or Paris or whatever it was. Same city. two totally different managers, and if they're footballing reasons, you're going to Manchester City. And I totally agree about the Sterling Martial. It's a good reference point, because the way them two have gone, Martial's shown glimpses because he's a quality player.
And where would Sterling be if he'd gone under Mourinho?
Oh, he'd be Luke Shaw territory, wasn't he?
He'd be at Bournemouth. He would have to resurrect his career. And again, look, I mean, even Mourinho at the end, this fantastic result, like this really big night for the club. And I don't know, look, people can dismiss the traditions and the Manchester United way. I totally get that it's a little bit, yeah, a little bit sickly. But there were moments of class about the club. Mm. There really were under Ferguson. He had his bad moments too. But when you've won, at least be a gracious winner. And Mourinho going on and confronting Bonucci. And like Graham Souness summed it up last night, he always finds a way to make it about himself.
Yeah.
And Souness was arguing, why not celebrate with your backroom staff that huge win and go on and high-five the players and actually have a feeling of goodwill around. Yeah. Instead, it's this toxic element that he introduces.
I did hear Mick coming back with a good line to Graham, though. Didn't you plant a flag in the middle of a pitch in Istanbul?
Look, that one could be levelled at Souness. But in fairness to Souness, he wasn't in that every week, whereas this is every week.
Yeah, I know. It's just Mourinho.
It's a fantastic result. It's an amazing result. But I would just ask you, I mean, you're... Obviously, you've got a feel for these things more than I would, but I don't feel it's some massive corner turned.
No, either do I.
I don't think I'd be sitting here in January and I would bet you my house that he won't be playing five at the back with McAtamney again.
Yeah, I agree. And the reason I'm pointing out that little run that this side is on, and it has got better, and there are more positive signs, is because when you go back to that time, I thought he was done and dusted. I really did, because it was toxic.
Around the new
whole atmosphere, yeah. Mm. Like before that, and the manner of the defeats and all the stuff that was creeping out, and just his general demeanour, it was at an all-time low. So that's my point. I do think they've turned a corner, but I agree, last night, it's not as if you're kind of going, that's it.
That's
now.
The formula.
That's it.
That's the point, yeah.
Because you're right, it's certainly not a masterstroke. It's not, it's needs must, it's what can we do?
And
it's
the big lad on.
It's Fellaini.
The one thing I'd ask you then, so around that Newcastle time, the players have kept playing for him.
Yeah, they have.
You know, like when I kind of level all the stuff where the concerns and the issues you'd have with Mourinho and Manchester United and where it's going, the players have not downed tools at all. And last night they couldn't have worked harder. So
I think there's maybe been a change in the last couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks, maybe a little bit more of a relaxed atmosphere. I don't know. I'm guessing because they look like they're playing with a little bit more freedom. They look like they're playing with a little bit more belief. Tactically, I don't think too much has changed. Maybe barring Lukaku being out of the side and having more of a mobile front three. Yeah. But I do think they have been better, and there has been a kind of little bit more relaxed feel about the players in the last few weeks, whether that's directly down to him or players getting together and saying, look, let's just put that to one side. This is embarrassing. We're getting...
Maybe. There. It'd be interesting to see where it goes. Before you leave that game, I mean, you have to talk about the Ronaldo goal.
Oh, Christ.
You don't have to drop an F-bomb.
No.
You talk about it.
What a goal. I was at home watching it. Did I say that?
That's
allowed?
All we need to say.
Oh, I was watching it at home and I didn't see it live. And then my wife's sister's over with a fella, and he was just like, wow. Well, I was like, literally, like, what's going on here? Seeing the replay. First of all, I seen him produce his 12 pack, and I was like, oh, get off me telly. Then I was just like, wow, is right. That is a phenomenal goal. Phenomenal. He didn't even look, and he's buried it past the hair. Mm. Gah, what a goal.
Everything about it. Because he makes the little run, and that sends Lindelof back, so he's not going to be offside, and then he gets a proper run on him. So
quality.
You never talk, quality. On the many, many things you talk about Ronaldo, bottom of the list, because it's the least exciting thing to talk about, the timing of his runs.
Yeah.
Like he made a move, then Lindelof had to go back.
To go back. And then,
he knows, I'm onside now. I've got you.
Yeah.
I've got you in front of me, and I can take off.
Joe, even when it lands, like, how many other players produce that? They do well to get it on target. Never mind. And he didn't even smash it. He just met it clean. Over a shot. Not even looking where the head of the goal is. Just knows the area of the pitch that he's in and flies past.
You know what struck me in the replay as well? I mean, look, it's a difficult skill no matter what. But even this ball, it wasn't one of those ones that's hit straight with backspin. Mm. It was actually curled in right to left.
Yeah.
So there's an extra little bit of having to get the flight of this ball, you know. And I was thinking of that program a couple of years ago where Ronaldo does all these tests where, like, someone hits a corner and they turn off the lights. Did you see that show?
No.
They did this thing a couple of years ago. I mean, it was PR guff ultimately, but they did different things, Ronaldo doing different skill tests. And one of them was, you know, his ability just by seeing, you could do it. I mean, mere mortals couldn't, right. But anyone who's played at your level could very easily, I'm sure. Just so he'd have someone take a corner and he's in the penalty box. It's in a studio so they can control
the lights.
I've
read about this. I didn't see it.
So guy takes the corner and as soon as he kicks the ball,
the lights go off. Yeah.
And just by the body shape and the way he's seen connection with the ball, Ronaldo can judge the flight of the ball. So all you have is darkness.
Right.
And then you just hear...
bang.
And then you hear the net ripple.
Really?
Yeah. And then you get to watch it back.
Consistently.
I don't know how many times they did it, actually. Right. But then you get to watch it back with the night vision cameras.
Yeah.
And so it's not the cleanest strike Ronaldo's ever had, but it's still not bad.
Yeah.
And it made me think of that last night, that he looked over his shoulder, saw the kick, and he's half watching the ball, and it's just...
phenomenal.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. Spurs, struggle, but got there. I've got a lot of sympathy for Spurs, actually. I really do. But the whole contract situation of players, the stadium dilemma, the manager getting linked to Real Madrid, how serious, I'm not quite sure. But players-wise, all they've really lost in the last couple of years is Kyle Walker. I thought there'd be a lot more. And there's a lot been made about players not coming in the summer, which undoubtedly has an impact. The pitch is a disgrace after that game against the NFL game they played the day after against Man City. And because that game got brought back because of the NFL game, not in their new stadium, they had to end up playing 4 games in 8 days in 3 different competitions. I feel for them because I think in Daniel Levy they've got someone as good as there is in that area of expertise
it's
at football clubs.
Levy is derided, you know,
I think he's doing a good job.
Yeah.
I really do. I think he's trying to move the club on. But I think the unfortunate aspect of it is the timing of this stadium is at a time where they've had the best side or the nucleus of a side squad that they could have done something really special with it.
Yeah.
But they haven't been able to add to that because of the stadium in the background and the financial implications. They have to balance the books. They can't be silly with it. Like we've seen Arsenal go into the Emirates and for years they had to just sell. So I feel really, really sorry for them. And I think Pochettino is doing as well as he can in the predicament he finds himself. And I feel for some of the players because the younger ones, maybe not so much because they've got time on their hands.
Mm.
But if you look at someone like Alderweireld, Eriksen to a degree, late 20s, you want to be financially rewarded for how good you are.
Yeah.
And comparatively, what that level of player is getting elsewhere. So Raheem Sterling, $300,000 a week reportedly at Man City. Dele Alli signs him for $100,000 a week. Don't think there's that much of it.
No.
Between them, Eriksen and Alderweireld, I've already mentioned. You want to win medals, Joe. You want to win trophies. And you get into that stage in your career. Like Dele Alli's all right because he's got another 10 years plus at the top level.
Yeah, you do get the sense with Spurs that they've had quite a rare thing in football in the last couple of years whereby they've recognised this is quite a good thing.
Mm.
We've got a good manager. White Hart Lane's a great stadium. Good group of players, no big egos. Even our best player, Harry Kane, can set a tone by not being greedy and not wanting away. And actually, we're improving and Champions League and pushing for the league. And almost the Eriksen types, their late 20s, have sort of said, OK, look, an extra $50,000 a week would be nice, but you know what, maybe this is kind of something special.
Mm.
And you do sense that that has been chipped away at in the last 6 months. And so,
I think he's constantly putting fires out. I think he's been brilliant, Pochettino, I really do. He adheres to what's going on above and tries to keep that relationship as good as it can be with Daniel Levy and the hierarchy. And then also, can you imagine what's going on like day to day? Players know what everybody else is on. They go and play England together.
Yeah.
They know what's going on with other clubs.
Well, remember Danny Rose came out and said, we're being underpaid, it's crap. I mean, the concrete reports were when Danny Rose came back into the dressing room, he got a standing ovation. They all started saying, good on you for saying it, you know? Like, I guess the worry for the worst case scenario for Spurs fans is Pochettino says, look, I can't keep hanging around this for much longer and gets an offer he can't refuse. Maybe it's Madrid, maybe it's not. And then once one or two players goes, it could be a house of cards situation.
Oh, snowballs. Big time. I totally agree. Totally agree. Yeah, but look, they got the win. They're still in, you know, they've got an uphill task. It's still going to be very unlikely that they get through. But I just think, look, that's where you are right now. I don't think you can expect much more. But having said that, should have beaten Inter match day one. We're in pole position, 2 late goals. Should have beaten PSV 2 weeks ago in Eindhoven. So they should be 5 points better off than what they are.
It's a pity because actually they're probably never going to win the league this year, especially given the lack of recruitment. But their best 13 players were capable of having a crack at the Champions League.
I agree,
knockout stages.
13, 14
that
players,
would have been, you know, that would have made it a great season.
Yeah, exactly. But, they are where they are, top four would be a good achievement. Quickly on Liverpool, I think he's going to get criticised and has been criticised for his team selection. I didn't have so much of it.
Okay.
We differed in the studio, didn't I? Myself, Kevin and Graham Souness. Graham Souness in particular thought he should have played his strongest team. My thought process was that Matip coming in was a mistake, because I think Gomez and Van Dijk are forging a really good partnership, and I think at the back there's different types of energy levels. You don't sprint as much, you don't use as much energy and as you do in those forward areas. So Lallana and Sturridge coming in, I didn't have a problem with. Having said that, I thought Sturridge was poor, really, really poor. I was thinking, here's your opportunity. We've seen Shaqiri in recent weeks, who wasn't brought. Again, I agreed with that decision. Can't go then in hindsight and go, well, he should have, they needed him. Sturridge was really poor, really, really poor. Surely to God, now he realises what is the minimum requirement playing in a front three for Liverpool in terms of energy levels. Yeah. And he was strolling. Really? A lot he made about was miss. Should have put them 1-0 ahead. Really, really good opportunity. Didn't. Haven't got a problem with that. That happens. Strolling.
Was he? That's surprising, because so much of the... I mean, I was in here, so I didn't see it that closely.
Yeah, it's hard when you're in here, isn't it?
So much of the talk was that Sturridge had seen the light over the summer.
I think he's been brilliant this season. That's what I'm getting at. I think he deserved his start. And Lallana coming back gives him something different in midfield to play alongside Wijnaldum and Milner. No problem with that. But they just, like, they've gone from 7 wins in a row at the start of the season now. That's 3 wins in their last 9. So, look, there's a lot being made about the style of play, the way they've changed it. I'm amazed how much it's changed compared to last season, to what we're seeing now from Liverpool. Even in those first 7 games, it was nowhere near the level of what we've seen last season at their best. It's just such a difference to what we've seen.
Can you put... Because I'm quite confused. Can you... defensively, they've now transformed. It's fantastic.
Yeah, a lot more solid.
Can you put your finger on why that front three and the attacking game isn't clicking as much?
Well, I think the front... Well, the whole team isn't as open, isn't as explosive, isn't as dynamic, which has a knock-on effect for the front three, because there's more of a pragmatic approach at times in the way they play, more conservative. And also, they set the bar that high last year. Especially Salah, too much is getting made of him. But it's definitely not coming off to the levels it did last year, for him in particular. Firmino as well, actually, which...
He looks tired.
A little bit, maybe, yeah. But I did think he made a difference coming on. Sturridge, even off the ball, like just tracing back, carrying back, setting the tone. Like, he was the one last year, really, that set the tone, wasn't he? And the others kind of joined in and got around that. But yeah, it's difficult. I want to move on to the Ireland under 21s. Manager jobs come available. It's been a lot made. There's a piece today in the Herald, Aidan Fitzmaurice. Lee Carsley in the frame for the under 21s job. I think he would be a magnificent appointment. I really do. We've got Stephen Reid joining us in a while. Again, him into that equation. Ideally, I think it would be an ex-player or some ex-player part of the process. But when you look at those two in particular, and I would chuck Damien Duff into that equation as well, the ex-players that have taken their coaching very, very seriously, it can't just be an ex-player for ex-player's sake.
Yeah.
That's just ridiculous. That just doesn't work. So you've got to identify who has done what at what level. Lee Carsley, well involved with the FA in England. He's coached at Brentford. He's coached at Birmingham.
Man City.
Highly regarded Man City's academy,
I didn't realise, actually, I must confess, because it's hard to keep track of everything, I didn't realise how highly regarded Carsley was until Kev started working on the show.
Oh, right. As a coach in general, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
And as an underage coach, all that he's done, because it's underage football, so you're not seeing everything. And just how highly regarded he is within the FA, to the point where I wonder, actually, if he'd even be interested in the
I don't think we'll get him. I genuinely don't think we'll get him.
He's above it.
But I would suggest so.
Yeah.
But I would also suggest it's a bit of a missed opportunity, because if you can recognise someone's a very good coach like that, like him, like Stephen Reid is, but you listen to players and the managers that Stephen Reid, and we'll speak to him about it in a little bit, who he's worked with, the likes of Roy Hodgson, Yap Stam, Steve Clark, he's been in and around it now for a few years. He's out of work at the moment, by choice, I should say, because he left Crystal Palace at the end of the season. Again, he does little bits and bobs with the FA. Can we get in there and maybe do something like that? But I think Lee Carsley is probably out of our reach, I agree. But that's the bar we need to be going at.
Yeah, because I've seen Robbie Keane's been talked about a lot, but I don't think he's started his pro licence yet.
No, hasn't started his pro licence. I think he starts in January, if memory serves me right.
Like, obviously his time will come.
Yeah.
But I just wonder if that might be a bit premature. Like, if you want to get someone in who's a bit more experienced.
the experience factors and working with players in and around that age as well, which Lee Carsley has in abundance with the FA. You know, it's this is where we need to be pitching at this type of level. Now there's a new influx. I did it a few years ago. Kenny did it with the underage teams. There's a new influx now of the likes of Andy Reid, Sean St. Ledger, Richard Dunn's involved.
Mark Kitzel has been working with.
Yeah, Mark's been involved. Again, I don't really know too much about what Mark's done coaching wise. I know he was involved with Rotherham United as well, wasn't he?
Yeah.
But all I know is about you said you weren't aware about Lee Carsley. Well, if there's good coaches in the game, you hear about it because word of mouth
spreads. Yeah.
Players talk to agents. Players talk to other players. Players talk to other coaches, and it gets around. So quickly. Like Steve McLaren as a prime example years and years ago had an unbelievable reputation as a coach. It just goes. And Lee Carsley has that.
It's fantastic, yeah. And so like, I mean, you and Kenny were involved briefly. Briefly being the operative word here. Why is that not a long-term thing? Like why, so Kenny did a stint where he wasn't the manager with the 19s, but he was there as a sounding board and blah, blah, blah. So like, where's the long-term plan? Go in, do a little bit so... I don't know what happened there. I don't know if there was a falling out or if it just ran to a natural end or if Kenny had other things going on. But why is it not like, well, okay, do a year with the 19s manager, then do the 16s manager, then do the 21s manager.
Yeah.
And the same with you. I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, but
no,
I saw you guys going in and then you're back out. And I'm, well, so what's the strategic
plan? Well, I don't know with Kenny, but in my particular case, it was very much, I took a year out after leaving MK Dons as the first team coach. Was on the pro licence, was on a course in England as well. I started to do a little more media. And I worked with the 16s, 17s primarily, and 18s. And enjoyed my time and wanted to stay involved. And for one reason or another, it didn't particularly happen. You know, I wanted to remain part of the underage setup because I enjoyed it. But, you know, it was a case of I can't keep doing this forever. There needs to be an actual role. And that didn't really come to fruition.
So it was in, when you say an actual role, in an ideal world, you might have liked the FAI to say, well, you didn't have a role then. What was your
role was, it was a year that I was willing to say, right,
like
here's where I am.
Like a volunteer kind of thing, almost?
So,
okay.
Done, which was helping me as well, because I was obviously on a course of doing licences, doing different courses, managerial courses, and to be involved with the teams, to see how international setups worked, as a coach, as a manager, at the analyst side of it, all the rest of the time constraints that you have at international level compared to club level. So all that was really good for me. But obviously you can't keep that going. It's just ridiculous. And the amount of time I was away from home. So I wanted to stay involved with it, but didn't
no
really.
No offer of anything?
Yeah, eventually, but it came too late.
Right.
Which was a shame, because I'd already moved on to doing other bits and bobs and committing
See,
my
just,
time.
Look, that kind of stuff. You know, that's where you kind of wonder how the organisation is run at times. Like, that doesn't sound like your experience was great or like you were really made feel. You're a former player, you've played at the top level, let's get you involved and give you something which you can jump at and make it easy for you to say yes, is my point.
Well, I think that, and this is the point I'm trying to make, if, and I'm not necessarily talking this about me,
sure.
If there's a player, ex-player that you've identified that is a good coach,
yeah.
We should be learning from the mistakes that we made, Lee Carsley being a prime example. And I don't know the circumstance exactly what happened a few years ago, but if we could have got him as part of his education as a coach at club level, whatever he was doing, then it would have obviously been beneficial for our underage players. And then that link that we're talking about between the senior team, the 21s and down, there needs to be a pivotal role there for someone like Lee Carsley, Stephen Reid, Damien Duff, whoever it is that is focused on coaching and has a desire and is willing to put in the hard work, which all those three have done, then it's a no-brainer, isn't it?
You would think so. The draw for the under-21 qualifying campaign is in December 12th, I think. So in an ideal world, they might like to have someone in place then. So we might see you over the next few weeks.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. Okay, I want to touch on Premier League relegation scrap. I know you're cracking into this, Joe. It's the second season, so a few of those I'm sure will be making changes in the not too distant future. Huddersfield Fulham was on Monday night. I don't know whether you've seen much of that. You were probably in here seeing bits and bobs of it, were you?
In here.
Yeah, so nailed on for me, home win. Covered Fulham twice in the last few weeks. To give a background on Fulham, they've spent about £100 million in the summer. Got promoted in a really stylish manner, playing magnificent football. A couple of players in particular, Sean Young-Ryan Sessegnon, he's only 18 years of age, Kearney the captain, brought in all these players, chucked a load of them in at the same time at the start of the season. It just hasn't worked. Mm. Trying to find that balance, constantly changing a back four. Kept it fairly familiar in the last few weeks. But again, like the centre-half issue in particular, Dennis Odoi, Tim Ream, I wasn't convinced by them last year in the Championship, and here they are playing in the Premier League. So they just haven't found that balance, and they still want to play in a very stylish, open manner. I don't know if you've ever been to Huddersfield, have you? Not a nice place to go and play football, especially with the fans, with the way they are. They've kept on board with the whole euphoria of getting promoted. The novelty of being in the Premier League is still there. The fans are amazing. It rocks. It's windy. All four corners of the ground is open. It's always windy. It's a little bit like Stoke.
Yeah.
So this was a banker home win for me, because I look at the two sets of players, the way they play, Fulham wanting to play in a certain way. Huddersfield aren't, they were a little bit more direct on Monday, but they can roll their sleeves up, they can scrap, they can fight. They proved it last year, and they have got quality in certain areas. Centre forward is an issue. Meunier and De Poitre just look like they can't score goals, but I thought all day long it was a home win, banker. Having said that, I still think both of them are in trouble.
Okay,
but I think if Fulham make a managerial change, which is conceivable, let's be honest, because of the predicament they find themselves in, with the type of players that they have, if they can get things right defensively, they certainly have the players in an attacking fashion to cause problems, and if they get the balance right. But I think that the two of them are in for a tricky season, yeah, big time. The other one, which is, for me, at the start of the season, just seeing the table here, so Fulham are bottom, 5 points, Cardiff on 5 points, Huddersfield on six. I said at the start of the season that Huddersfield and Cardiff, for me, are absolutely nailed on for relegation. Mainly because of, I just thought, the start of last season, Huddersfield did so well, got themselves a little advantage by the points total that they got going in the first four, five, six games of the season.
Yeah.
They haven't managed to do that this year. I think it will be a struggle. So I think it's going to be them two plus AN. When you look at Cardiff, I don't know how they got promoted. I really don't. With the players they had, the squad they have, it was always going to be very difficult. Neil Warnock's on screen there. He's a big reason, obviously, why they got promoted. The spirit that they played with, they were so direct, so horrible and scrappy to play against. Mm. Nobody relished playing against them. So he was a huge factor in that. Haven't really invested a lot. Brought in Josh Murphy, Bobby Reid, Greg Harry Cunningham, Arthur. Harry Arthur on loan, yeah. So they brought in solid citizens. Goals, again, been an issue. And again, defensively, very much what they had last year, play very deep, rely on long throws, set pieces. It's not going to be enough. Not going to be enough.
Okay.
So for me, they're down. But no disgrace in that whatsoever. I think you use that money to make sure that the club is in a sound place, reinvest.
Well, the Sean Dyche Bournemouth come back. Example is the one.
Exactly.
It? It's a great way to get relegated.
Yeah, West Brom did it going back 10, 12 years ago, maybe the boing, boing, baggies, up, down, yo-yo club. Every time they went back down, bang, the club was in a sounder place to bounce back. And I think that's the template that Cardiff City need to use. Because a few years ago, they went up under Malky McCoy, dropped back down, and it was financially here. Wow, we're all over the place here. So they've done it in a sound way, even investment-wise, but they also need to be realistic. Like, is sacking Neil Warnock with that squad of players, if someone else comes in, I don't think they're going to do too much more, to be perfectly honest. Mm. Whereas you look at some of the other squads, Fulham, possibly someone might get a little more of a tune out of them. Southampton under Mark Hughes. I look at that squad, and how many times have we heard this? On paper, good squad. I'm not saying it, Joe, at all.
Okay.
I think they're strolling. I think some of the players are believing that the hype and their reputations, and they're not actually producing a level that you need intensity-wise to get results at Premier League level. So that's even coming from Mark Hughes.
Yeah.
Or it's coming from the players themselves.
What's the word on Mark Hughes as a manager?
Not sure, Joe, to be honest. Yeah, I would question it. Never mind the word. What I would suggest about in the last 2-3 years, which I've been doing this job, and I go over and commentate on Premier League games every Saturday, I would have seen his Stoke side quite a bit. I have to say, when I got my schedule on my road and I had to go and see Stoke, I never enjoyed it. They were probably my least favourite team over the last couple of years when he was in charge, because I didn't know what they were. You knew what they were under Tony Pulis. You might not like the style of play, but you knew what they were doing. He tried to change that. Some of the recruitment was shocking. It really was. And I didn't know what they were. Now, he kept Southampton up at the end of last season, But again, I go back to the squad. I think there was decent ingredients for him to work with there. But they should not be in a relegation fight. They really shouldn't. They should be comfortably mid-table, looking to beat at Burnley, like Watford, like Bournemouth are this year, the Burnley of last year, who can get 6th, 7th, 8th position, whatever that's going to be in the league. Southampton should be in that bracket. But they're not. There's a couple of others. I think Palace are going to be fine. I think Burnley are going to be fine. They're just getting over the Europa League tough transfer window that they had, and the whole euphoria of last year under Sean Dyche. It's very, very hard to emulate what they did last year, and maybe a little bit of that, but I think he'll get it back on. I think we've already seen signs of that.
He'll stay calm as well, as important.
West Ham, poor start, got it going. Declan Rice isn't doing too well, is he?
I just saw Jamie Redknapp last week was the latest.
Oh, jumping on the bandwagon.
He watched Rice in that first game against Liverpool. Remember, he got taken off at half time.
I wasn't having that, by the way, that first. He got thrown under the bus.
A little bit. It's easy to pull off the 19-year-old kid when it's not going well. But Redknapp was saying, last few weeks, he's totally won me over. And Gareth Southgate should be knocking on this young man's door.
Do me a favour, Jamie. Do me a favour. Right, moving on. We've got Stephen Reid joining us on the line. Stephen, thanks for joining us, pal.
No problems. Keith, I just bumped into Alan Judge, actually. I was just wandering along. So I've just been talking about knees and rehab for the last 15 minutes.
Did you really bump into Alan Judge?
It's good to see him. Hello, sorry?
You just bumped into Alan Judge, seriously?
Alan Judge, seriously. I've just popped into town and Alan Judge, I just see him there with his missus and the kids.
No way.
As we always do when I bump into him, we usually end up talking about
the game ready and Dave Fever, the physio.
Game ready, all the injuries. I told him not to wander too far in case his knee starts swelling up. It was good to see him. Good to have a chat.
He's a good lad. He's a good player. Alan Judge would have been at Blackburn when we were
he
there
would
together.
Have. He was
a great young player.
We spoke a little bit about that, and we spoke about, because our injuries came at a similar time, because he was absolutely flying when he obviously had his ACL reconstruction, and he's still trying to find his feet and get back to his best where he was. I remember seeing him and being in a Reading squad and involved at Reading when he was flying. So hopefully he gets back on track.
Yeah, I totally agree.
When you say pop into town, where is popping into town these days?
Well, Kingston. It's just pretty local now. I ended up moving sort of back down south. I was in Manchester, as Keith knows, for 15 years through my time at Blackburn and West Brom. But a couple of years ago, we decided to move back down south, back to London.
Back to the smoke, pal. Back to the smoke.
Back to the smoke. Back to the smoke, mate.
Listen, you left Crystal Palace at the end of the season. Tell us a little bit about what you've been doing since. Has it been family time, just taking that little bit of time out to chill out a bit? Because you went straight into coaching for playing, didn't you?
A little bit of family time, Keith. I've sort of taken myself away from football a little bit. I've been to a couple of pro license events. I graduated in the summer and got my pro license, but just started to get to a few games now. I'm going to West Brom at the weekend, and then going to do the Manchester Derby for you guys on Sunday, and then St George's Park again for a couple of days next week. So a few little bits and pieces, and catching up with people that I've not seen for a while, because as you know, Keith, you've been in it coaching and playing. Sometimes there's an old saying, it ships in the night, and you don't catch up with people. But I've actually been doing a bit of that. I went up to Burnley to see Daishi and watch them train for a couple of days. So it's been good, actually. It's been good to get a little breather, because the last few years has been pretty full on.
Yeah, Joe, we were speaking earlier on. I told you when Stephen was coming on, and the first thing you said, what you wanted to talk about, was the role of an assistant manager stroke coach, wasn't it? And the time-wise.
Well, I'm very curious. So, I mean, it strikes me looking in from afar. I mean, you can put me wrong here, but the amount of time that the assistant has to put in, the money, all the glory, you know, being the manager is clearly, you know, you're kind of top dog, and then there's such a big fall off in the number two, and I don't think we fully get it. It was something Kev mentioned to me a while back, just how demanding the number two job is for, you know, a lot less of the glory, a lot less of the money, all the trappings.
Yeah.
You've kind of been on that train.
Yeah, and it is full on. I literally went from playing into 2 weeks later, after retiring from playing, I was straight in at the deep end at Reading with Steve Clark, and didn't really get any chance there to reflect on my career. Obviously, Keith knows the sort of turmoil at times I went through with the knee injuries, and the last 5-6 years of playing was really tough. And then to go straight into the coaching scene, which was obviously a great opportunity for a couple of years at Reading, it was tough. But you're right, you're so full on. And one of the most difficult things about it is the fact that you've got to come in every day motivated, enthusiastic, even when you're feeling terrible. You know, you might have lost the game the day before. Obviously, last season at Palace, we lost the first 7 and had no points and no goals. So you still got to come in positive. You still got to come in and try and lift the players, and at times lift the manager as well. And you sort of get caught in the middle a little bit where, actually, who's there to give you a lift when you need it, maybe? Because there isn't anyone, really. It's just your job I saw it as my job to try and lift the players, lift the group, but also when the manager was having those low moments, try and manage him and lift him as well. So it's non-stop. It really is full on.
And you can be the guy who's told, well, can you come in first thing in the morning, and then also can you maybe go and have a look at that team we're playing in 2 weeks' time, you know, 8-9 o'clock at night? Like, the hours, I hadn't fully appreciated, are absolutely ferocious at times.
Well, it is full on. It's, I know people say it, I'm sure people know, it's not your normal sort of 8-6 or 9-5 job, and you can put your computer away and chill out and relax with the family, because it is full on the whole time. You might be in training all day, and then you've got to go to a game and scout a game in the evening. Mm. And even when I had a day off, it's not really a day off, because I'd be watching clips. The last couple of years, I had the job of sort of set plays as well, so I'd be watching corners, free kicks, for and against, the strengths and weaknesses, and starting to put, especially at Reading, second year at Reading, was putting the video together ourselves. Changed a little bit at Palace, where the analysts would have more of a influence on that. But on your days off, you're thinking about the next day. You're thinking about the training session. Mm. Who's training? You might have to speak with a doctor. You might have to go through a meeting that you're going to take the next morning, and trying to prep yourself for that. So it is full on. It's non-stop. And I just found that you've not really got any days where you can really, really relax, because even if you do win a game, it's on to the next one. Within that initial relief and joy of the 3 points, within a short space of time, it's right, let's start watching clips and get ready for the next game, whether that's on the Tuesday or whether that's the next weekend.
That's where coaching, that's where modern day management is now. That's the level. And I read a piece in the paper last week, and it was the Guardian, maybe, spent the week with Javi Grazia at Watford. I don't know if you read it, and his schedule was exactly what Stephen's saying. So Stephen's first team coach at Crystal Palace, he's the go-between a lot of the times, between the analyst, who we both know, a lad called Rob. He would be looking at those clips, the sports science department. That is the role. It is 24/7.
Everyone's coming
non-stop. Yeah. And it takes its toll.
And alongside that, Keith, as well, you sort of got to filter out a lot of the noise. You've got to sort of decide, do I need to tell the manager that?
Yeah.
And you've got to, all the time, medical issues, sports science issues. The manager, I don't want to speak to the manager about that. He's got enough on his plate. And you've sort of got to filter out the information that you do give him. Some managers want to know everything. Some managers don't want to know anything unless it's a crisis, unless it's an emergency. So there's all sorts going on.
That's very interesting.
It is relentless.
Didn't realise that some managers would be kind of like, you know, we were sort of half liking it outside to, I don't know, a law firm where you've got the partner, and then the assistant manager is the poor lad in his first year in there doing all the grunt work down the bottom, and only if it's really a big issue does it go upstairs, you know?
Most of, like, whether it's players that Stephen's talking about, or the different departments within the football club, medical, sports science, analysis, it's like it's grown so much,
and
these different departments in the last year. And everybody goes to the number two or the first team coach, because, again, if we go back to when we were players, we'll have a moan up to the coach, because we know that'll get filtered back, whereas you wouldn't maybe be as brave as saying that to the manager.
Door. Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so is it like a touch of burnout with it, Stephen, or do you want to get back in, or did it kind of put you off doing the role?
No, it doesn't put me off it. I think the experiences that I had were incredible, and I still don't think that you can ever beat that feeling of winning a game, whether that's as a player or whether you're on the coaching staff. You just can't replace that feeling of winning a game, knowing what you've done during the week, especially on the coaching side. When you've worked all week, you might have had your individual meetings with a couple of players and see them deliver on a Saturday and go on and win the game. So I don't think it will be a case of walking away for good. I think it was just a case of just felt it was a time to enjoy the family a little bit more. I think this goes back to my last 6-7 years of playing, where when I look back at it now, for the whole of the kids' lives, I was icing my knee, I was flying all around the world for career ending surgery, potentially career saving surgeries, and I probably at times wasn't in a great place and never really had time to reflect on that, to look back at it, to actually enjoy some quality time with the family, because laughing about it now, but sort of seeing Judgy there on his day off, and I used to remember those when I had to think about, could I go out with the missus and the kids and push the pram around, because my knee was starting to swell up, just little things like that you take for granted, but that might mean you playing on a Saturday or a Tuesday night or missing the game because the knee's too swollen. So I think it's just a case of just taking a step back, having a bit of a breather, but still doing the bits of involvement with the coaching badges that I've started to help out a little bit with, and going to games as well. So I'm looking forward to the weekend, the West Brom one on Saturday and the Manchester derby on Sunday.
We were just chatting before you came on. I don't really caught the end of it, maybe, about the Ireland 21's job. Lee Carr, as you've been linked with it today. And I was making the point that just because you're an ex-Irish international doesn't mean you should be associated with this type of job. And I've been involved with the underage teams. But the point I was making was he's certainly gone around things the right way. He's involved with the FA. And I know you do bits and bobs with the FA, and you've obviously got your pro license over there. It's players, ex-players and coaches like him, like you, and I threw Duffer into the equation because he's taking it very seriously as well. Would that be something that might tempt you?
I think it could possibly. It definitely could. I know, obviously, having spoken to you over time, Keith, and especially when we spoke about it, or when we briefly spoke about it earlier on today about that role, and I think it's an important role. You know, you're looking at a 21s group that are still in, most of them, in their development stage of their career. So I don't think it can go to someone that has no experience of that type of role or working in the game. For me, it'd be a difficult one to be a first job in football to head that up, because it's, you've got to inspire this group. This hopefully will be the group that will then start dipping their toe into the senior set up, like you see with Gareth Southgate now. You've almost got players bypassing playing Premier League football almost and going straight from the 21s into the senior group.
Yeah.
So I don't see why that can't be a similar situation, where you've got a group that are improving and developing in the 21s that then join the senior group. Because I still remember when I played 21s football, I used to absolutely buzz for meeting up. And when we used to have a 21s game against the senior team, the senior 11, and it was brilliant. And anyone that did well in that group and that 21s game against the seniors, Mick would throw in. He would call them over for a couple of training sessions. But that's why it's so important that 21s group are looked after, that are developed with good quality coaching that can hopefully help them along the way.
Yeah, I've constantly said about, and we were only chatting about it before, weren't we, about that link between, whereas at the moment I feel like the link isn't there between our senior team, our 21s. It seems that there's a big bridge between that, and gone are the days where, Stephen just mentioned, we're trained in the same place or arranged those early parts of the week of playing those little games against each other. And players like Stephen, obviously, Sean, where he got the opportunity, Mick throws him in because of certain things that he sees. So it's a massive it's a massive appointment for us.
And Stephen, do you mind me asking, because I mean it's relatively fresh news that Noel King is stepping aside and moving elsewhere within the FAI. How does the process tend to work now? I mean, are you expected to apply and send in some kind of CV? Is there someone that you potentially phone, or do you just wait by the phone yourself and you hope maybe if it rings you have a chat? Like, is there any set way this thing works?
I think his agent's sat here, isn't he? Me.
Yeah.
I mean, Keith Andrews is obviously getting 10%, but just in terms of...
But yeah, Keith makes a good point. I think if you're actively looking to get back in, you'd probably have an agent that would make a call, or you might know someone that's got a role at a club or is involved in the selection process that you might contact and let them know about your availability. The FAI might have someone in mind already, and it works the same at club level. Yeah. They might already have someone in mind already that they're earmarked. They still might advertise the role, but they might know that they know who they want in that role. But agents are playing a bigger and bigger part in not just, we're not talking about the top end of Premier League managers and coaches. You're talking all the way through the system, mm-hmm. from Premier League level all the way down to grassroots level, that you're going to be getting coaches that know someone or got an agent or know someone that can make the phone call, make the email and let your interest known. So also probably a little bit of word of mouth. It might be an article that a couple of names have mentioned, like Lee Carsley's been mentioned a few times about that role, and maybe someone in the FAI might see that and might not even know what he's up to. As stupid as it sounds, something like that, because even when I was working at Crystal Palace or Reading, I'd bump into people and say that I was at Reading or Palace, and it would be, oh, what role have you got there? What age group are you taking?
People
don't know sometimes until they actually see you on the telly or read about it in the newspaper.
Mm. Not to turn this into a de facto job interview, but you've worked under some really good managers. You know, I think Roy Hodgson, everybody understands, knows how to set up a team, and Yap Stam and various people.
Yeah.
Who do you feel has shaped you? I guess it applies to your playing career as well as your coaching career. You know, when you're thinking about the manager you're going to be and how you might set up a team, whose voice is in your head, or what kind of lessons have you taken from people in particular?
I think there genuinely is a mixture. I think the way that Roy conducts himself on and away from the training ground is first class. I think he was speaking to people within the club, the players, staff. I think when he came in, and obviously I came in alongside with Ray Lewington as well, I think it brought a breath of fresh air. I think the respect that he's got for everyone at the club, he goes in the physio room every day to check on the injuries, he speaks seven languages, so he had the respect of a lot of the players from the start. You know, the French boys used to love him. You know, if you used to speak to them in French, he was, you know, they fell in love with him from the start. Just little bits like that.
Yeah.
Steve Clark's coaching and organisational skills were first class. So there is, I know people say it, and you sort of think as you go along, you'll take bits and pieces from each manager, but that genuinely is the case.
What are his seven languages?
He speaks Swedish, he speaks French, he speaks a little bit of Spanish, he speaks...
Italian, maybe?
I think Italian, sort of fluent in Italian. How many's that?
He's a cool customer, though, isn't he, really? The way I totally get the saying about the way he works, the way I would have got that as a player with him us together, but then you've seen a different side to that. Going on to the staff side, was he impressive in that aspect as well? Yeah,
but I just sort of carried it on, Keith. The way that I sort of went about my business as a player, that just sort of carried on when I worked alongside him.
Mm.
From being a player, I knew when he had the ump or in a mood, and how to deal with him, how to work alongside him as a player, and that's exactly what I did as a coach. But seeing him firsthand, you know, from first thing in the morning till last thing during the day, he's just great at managing people. But more importantly than that, he's on the training ground every day, loves his coaching.
That's probably the biggest difference for me, really, with managers with all the greatest respect of his age. It's unusual that they are on the training ground that much. It's more, when they get to that age of their career, they're more,
usually the manager type, where they have younger coaches like Stephen doing the kind of the sessions where they chat about what are we doing? We're doing this. Mm. Yeah, Stephen, you take you. That's the difference with someone like Roy Hodgson, and it's I think it's quite unusual, but I do think it's come from his experience as a manager throughout Europe, and obviously he just loves it. He loves being on the grass, doesn't he?
And the lads respect that, Keith. You know, on a Sunday when you got maybe six or seven players that have not kicked a ball on a Saturday in the game, and the manager comes out on the Sunday to take a session.
Yeah.
That's quite rare, and I think the lads respect that, and that also helps you as well as a first-team coach, because when the manager's out there, don't care what anyone says, that gives the players an extra 5 or 10% when they're training.
Yeah.
As soon as the manager's not out there, rightly or wrongly, it's not quite got the same intensity. And I think he knows that. I think from the experience, he knows that. And he's out there every day. Mm. Doesn't have to. There are some days, don't get me wrong, when I was thinking, you know, I'll take this little bit. You don't really need to be getting him. But he can't help it. He can't help but get involved. And I think that brings a respect around the club.
I presume, Stephen, you want to take a top job, be a manager somewhere, as opposed to staying having a career as a number two.
Yeah, I think after the last 3 years, and you know, you get a feel of what you like, what you maybe don't like as much, and then you sometimes you get a little bit frustrated as well, and you sort of think, you know, I want to actually maybe even plan a session a day or two before, or whatever however you might want to work. And I think that's the ultimate aim, is to then all what you've learned along the way, all the bits that you like and you don't like, you can sort of mould that into your own way of working with great people that you've worked with along the way, because that's what you sort of identify straight away. And Keith mentioned a little bit earlier in the call about one of the analysts at Crystal Palace who's was spot on. You work with good people and you think, I'd like to work with someone like that later on down the line, and you sort of identify how you might do it and how you might want to work.
Yeah. And key question, would you be a tracksuit manager on the touchline, or are you going to go for a suit? Three-piece.
You better stick to tracksuits, I'm telling you.
Three-piece, surely.
Keith will have to point me in the right direction. I need to get a few new. I've been in a tracksuit for 3 years, so Keith might have to put, he's looking sharp these days when
sure
I see him
is,
on the box, so I'll have to give him a shout.
How are your knees, by the way? Can you go for a run of a Wednesday afternoon? Shocking.
Do you know, after I finished playing, everything settled down nicely and couldn't even look at a gym, let alone go in one. So everything was pretty good. And then back end of last season, I played a ball into a session and felt a strange click in the knee, and I sort of knew, you know, I can almost be a knee specialist, so I kind of knew what it was and settled down again. But I was away with the kids last week and I was on a big inflatable thing in the sea. I was away for a few days and the knee's just ballooned again.
Wow.
So I might have to have it looked at again. But apart from that, the bit of running was fine. I was going to be playing in the Soccer Sixes in January in Glasgow. So I think that's knocked on the head, which is a bit disappointing. But all in all, it's not too bad. And to be honest, don't have to train or play anymore. So, you know, it is what it is. At least I've not got that pressure now of trying to get the swelling down and the knee dictating the life, which is a good place to be.
Yeah. Before you go, you mentioned you're on commentary duty on Sunday. Well, I think you're with Nathan, aren't you, for the Manchester Derby?
I might be Dave, actually.
Are you with Dave? Apologies.
Yeah, I think I'm with Dave,
Good stuff.
He's got number one, that's important.
He has got number one, to be fair. Before you go, talking of Derby's, not particularly that one, but Derby's you played in. Well, what was the biggest one? Was it Millwall West Ham? Did you get to play in that one, or was it?
I didn't play it. To be
different leagues, were they?
I think the Blackburn Burnley one had quite a lot about it. Well, it was that one, or West Brom Wolves was massive as well, obviously. That.
So you played for Blackburn Burnley and Burnley Blackburn, didn't you?
Was that one, Keith?
You played Blackburn Burnley. Who was managing then?
That would have been. I think that would have been Sparky.
Was it, yeah?
I think it was a cup game. It was the one of the Burnley fans run on and got right in Savage's face and thought it was all going to kick off. Yeah. That was a tasty one. That was a really tasty one, and the West Brom Wolves one as well. Maybe not as much, but that was a real big derby, and they're the ones that I really did enjoy playing in. Enjoyed it when you used to get a bit of stick off the opposition fans. Yeah. They're some of the games that you remember when you finish, especially that derby win where we won 5-1 at Wolves. That was probably one of the highlights of my time at West Brom.
West Brom, yeah. Listen, good luck on Sunday. I hope it goes well with the A commentator, Dave. And
and I'll be talking to you from studio. You're surrounded by greatness.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
In a nice warm office.
And we'll nice keep you posted studio. About that 21s job, right? Thanks for joining us.
Boys.
See you, pal.
All right.
What a great fella. Yeah, he's a diamond. Yeah. Diamond. I've said it before when he's been on. I love being with him at both Blackburn and then we were together at West Brom. Just decent fella. And the injury troubles,
you were
like kind of going, wow. See it every day. Like when he was obviously injured, you would see the work that he would have to go through to get fit.
Mm.
But then even when he was fit, managing the knee and managing the sessions, the load, the game ready after, lived on ice machine called the game ready, if people aren't familiar with it. It's an ice machine, but it compresses as well. It was, you know, it was just part and parcel of him.
It's such a shame.
We'd all turn up with wash bags. He would turn up with it.
Really?
For the game ready.
It's such a shame.
That's where he was.
When he burst on the scene in 2002 and whacked that free kick off the bar, and he's so big and physical and good technically.
Quality player.
And even the way he segued into right back was a testament to how good a player he was.
Exactly.
Like, that game was by necessity. He was really good.
Not the quickest, not, in terms of been playing in that position where wingers were getting quicker and quicker and fullbacks were having to change the way they played. So you're right, to even evolve into that type of right back where he played really, really well at West Brom in particular, when he went there. Great fella.
You mentioned derbies. Here's Keith Andrews' big derby moment.
And pulls it back, and Andrews shoots and finds the net. And that is added, the final touch of humiliation to Wolves fans. A man who started his career at Molineux has finished them off this afternoon.
Well, he's obviously enjoyed that, hasn't he, Keith Andrews? You often see players coming back to former grounds and not celebrating, but none of that for Keith Andrews.
You Judas.
Well,
Keith Andrews. That was the day Nick McCarthy, that was his last game
Nick's
for Wolves
last
as
game,
well.
Yeah. So Nick hasn't mentioned that to me. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for nothing, Keith.
Wow.
Flat track bully. It was 5-0. Did you need to?
It was 4. I got the 5th. Left foot, bang.
Yeah. So what, did you think about not celebrating as a manager?
No chance. No chance. They held me for the guts of 2 to 3 years, Wolves, when I was under contract. So I was itching to get out of that place and forge a career for myself where I'd stuttered and stalled for the last few years. Went there as 15 and for the first 6 years, loved my time there. But the last few, just needed to get out a few long moves and just became stale. I fell out of love with football.
Really?
Being at Wolves, yeah. So when I went back there years and years later, having made a good career for myself and was relishing the opportunity at West Brom under Roy Hodgson, that was... Went there in the January. We had the Euros in the
2012,
summer.
2012, yeah.
I was playing well, playing really well, playing some of the best career, playing some of the best football in my career.
Mm.
That was just bang, let's have it and not celebrate. Not a chance.
You look incredibly. I mean, that photo, lean and strong. You look healthy. Like you look really in great shape. Yeah. Like you were playing the best football.
I was flying. Yeah, I was enjoying it. I mean, Reedy's even said it. Like Reedy had played God knows how many games before for West Brom. He'd been part of the promotion season. Mm. He even picks it out as one of the because it is the biggest derby in the Midlands for them too. Villa Birmingham is the big one for them.
Yeah.
And Wolves against West Brom, there is genuine hatred between those two clubs. So I've played obviously in ones for Wolves against West Brom. Had a really good win against a good West Brom side going back to when Gary Megson was the manager. I think Dave Jones was our manager back in like 2001-2, maybe something around that time. But then full circle 2012. Yeah, good crack getting to my car after that game, by the way.
I would think so.
Not like,
well, we're just being abused.
Just abuse getting ready to have it and didn't obviously get to that level, but good fun. I enjoyed my time at West Brom. It was Roy Hodgson going to be the England manager.
in the summer, killed that. He left. Steve Clarke came in. Contract offer wasn't there anymore, so I had to go on and kick on elsewhere, which was a real shame.
A few more years under Hodgson would have been just the ticket.
Loved working under him.
Yeah.
Loved working under him.
Well, I mean, with Reid, to get to see it, I mean, Hodgson, if he's known for nothing else, has had to set up a team.
Yeah.
So you've learnt, I guess, one of the masters in that, you know?
I can see where he's coming from in terms of the wanting to do a session his way, wanting to do this, wanting to do that. I think his next step will be as a manager somewhere.
And I sort of alluded to in the questioning, but in fairness, he's not going to talk about that, understandably, but like managers in Premier League now are pulling in a couple of million minimum a year. Like, it's a big old drop to the poor old assistants. Oh,
Joe, honestly.
People wouldn't believe how big a drop it is.
Wouldn't have a clue. Maybe not so much Premier League level. I think they get looked after, assistant managers in particular. Not then another drop to first team coaches, then big drops to analysts, etc., unless you're at the top clubs. Yeah. But then you drop out of the Premier League into the Championship and League Ones. Whew.
It's yeah.
Massive drop. Yeah. People massive. Think and the hours that Stephen's alluded, he's nailed on the head. Like, you're up non-stop. It's, you're in early. If you're doing it right,
yes.
And if you're going to have, in this day and age, if you're going to have a period of success, you need to be doing it right or you'll get found out.
Because people just assume everyone's awash with money. Like, everyone's on inflated wages, but actually it's not the case.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it ever a weird thing, I know, can't talk here all day. Was it ever a weird thing as a footballer to be on colossal money compared to the man in the street and walking by, I don't know, the receptionist and then the people in the canteen and the person washing jerseys? Did you ever think this is a bit weird?
Yeah, it's...
Is it there?
It's a good point because I think... maybe early part of your career you're just in the clouds or whatever, or whatever, but then I do think as you get that sense of where it is, and I think certain clubs, not just ones I've been at, but you know, the traditional one town clubs or whatever, they would take advantage of people in that town wanted to work for that football club because it was a slight kind of I work for that, but they would take advantage of that when it came to actually paying wages.
Yeah.
We had a big thing at MK Dons a few years ago where the Holy Grail was getting to the Championship. So 10, 12 years ago, we got from League Two as champions up to League One. I left then to go to Blackburn, but they stayed at that level. I went back then and I was the first team coach with Carl Robinson. We got them up. But some of the staff had remained throughout that whole period of 10 years. And the Holy Grail was get to the Championship, you'll get rewarded. Get to the, that was the carrot. Got to the Championship, did they get rewarded? Did they?
Yeah.
And it didn't sit well with me, really didn't sit well with me. Not for me, but for those other staff members who'd been on the whole journey, ups, downs, promises, false promises. And I think that's kind of, it's the way it is in football, unfortunately.
Because it's been an interesting thing recently where Premier League clubs in particular have been highlighted for not paying a living wage.
Yeah.
You know. And you look at the excesses at one end in comparison with people not being made the living wage. And
I'll tell you what does happen a lot. And with kit men, with the boot men, the cleaning lady, the canteen lady, whoever it is, I think players now are ridiculously generous.
Are they?
When it comes to Christmas. And not just the big clubs, you know, have whip-arounds at Christmas for local hospices, charities, things like that. And then people in and around the training ground too, if they get a few hundred quid, will make a big difference to their Christmas or whatever. And then I know for a fact the Man City boot boys and kit men are on a nice little number from all the players, so obviously that's at a different
level.
Have I got time to do Sheffield, Joe, or quickly
we've run over
Sheffield derby. Sheffield derby tomorrow, Steel City derby.
Yeah,
I think it's a proper derby. Got into a little bit with Stephen about the big derbies. I think some of them are a little bit kind of made more than what they are. I think this is a genuine one. Dates back to 1890. Sheffield United flying in third position, just a point off the top behind Leeds, Norwich sandwich in between. Real and Sheffield Wednesday 17th on 19 points. They've lost four in a row. There's a real contrast in the way these two teams have gone about things. Sheffield Wednesday in the last few years have spent some serious cash, really speculated to try and get over that line and get promotion. Didn't happen. Now it's, oh dear,
okay,
cutbacks, players going out on loan to get wages in, only one player being signed on a permanent basis in the last two transfer windows. It's a difficult time. The manager's come in, he's a German manager, Dutch manager, but he's more of a German type in terms of the way he goes about things, but they're all over the place at the moment. Defensively, 12 goals in the last four games now. Sheffield United, Chris Wilder, stood on the terraces in the 80s as a fan, watch him on the sideline, watch his team play. He basically says he wants his team to play in the way his fans, the fans want to watch football being played, front foot, in your face. They play three at the back with wing backs. The right side and the left side of the centre half of the three at the back overlap at times. Joe, I'm telling you.
Is this on TV on
Brilliant.
Friday?
It's on tomorrow night.
I'll have a look.
Sheffield United are one of the best teams to watch.
Okay.
Obviously, always doesn't come off. Very rarely a negative type game or a dull game when they are involved.
Okay.
So, really looking forward to that. Have to say, I fancy a Sheffield win.
On Derby, so the Manchester Derby, Sheffield Derby.
Yeah.
We were, you know, I was flicking through. There's all the obvious ones. Without question, the strangest derby I came across. This blew up last year, is Crystal Palace against Brighton.
Mm.
There's no historical links, industrial links.
It's a strange one.
This did not exist as a derby until the 70s.
Okay.
Okay, so that was when Alan Mullery took over at Brighton and Terry Venables came in at Palace. And so things kicked off in the late 70s when they played each other a bunch of times, FA Cups, various things. At one stage, Alan Mullery was walking out of the tunnel and someone threw boiling hot coffee all over him.
Yeah.
So Mullery took out all the money in his pocket and threw it on the ground and said, that's all you're all worth. Okay. So that kind of kicked things off. And it kind of ticked along various places. Where it really blew up was in 2013. So Amex Stadium. I'll read from The Guardian.
Go.
Brighton have launched an investigation after excrement. That's right, Keith. Excrement was found on the floor of the Crystal Palace dressing room.
Yeah, yeah.
Before Monday's Championship playoff second leg at the Amex Stadium.
Ian Holloway and Gus Poyet were the managers, I think.
Gus Poyet, the Brighton manager, wanted to get to the bottom of it. So he wrote an email to the staff. So the incident prompted a furious email to staff from the Brighton manager, Gus Poyet. He says, hello everyone. For some reason, that is still not clear to me, says Gus Poyet, someone during the day had access to the away dressing room and done something terrible. Trying to upset everyone at Palace. And then just to be clear about things, he says, to say it in clear English, someone had a poo. What an email to get. Everybody at Brighton.com. Someone had a poo all outside the toilets, over and around the toilets. I am angry that someone within this club would endanger our good reputation and stoop so low. Did they imagine this would affect Crystal Palace? Yeah, literally. Well, possibly it did. It may have fired them up. Well, somebody made a very bad decision. And I think it's time to stand up and take responsibility.
It's definitely a serious derby. I remember that. There's big rumours that was the Crystal Palace bus driver.
Oh, you can't. We can't libel anyone here on air, can we?
Big rumours.
Well, falsified rumours.
Well, we don't know.
Well, we don't know. Show. The Crystal Palace bus driver shat in his own team dressing room.
Apparently. Where's this show gone?
Allegedly, but probably not the case. Well, Gus Poyet seemed to think it was someone in the Brighton camp.
Okay.
That went across the room into the
Crystal
Palace.
I'll do a bit more digging on that and see if I can find that Crystal Palace bus driver.
Well, can we get him on the phone?
In fact, I should have asked really about
next week. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, if you're talking derbies.
Yeah, that's like, it, isn't
Brighton
it?
Brighton Crystal Palace is
that's
hard
the
to
peak.
Beat.
Yeah. Peak. All right. I think we've gone about 14 minutes over.
Okay. Pleasure.
Thanks. Flew again as usual. We've had some good, nice chat to really got through a few little bits and bobs. That's all we got time for, unfortunately. As per usual, download it from the usual place. Watch it back on YouTube. Until next week, we shall see you then.